Good afternoon. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to AstraZeneca's Investor Science Conference Call from ESC Paris. Before I hand over to AstraZeneca, I'd like to read the Safe Harbor statement. The company intends to utilize the Safe Harbor provisions of the United States Private Securities Litigation Reform Act of 1995. Participants on this call may make forward-looking statements with respect to the operations and financial performance of AstraZeneca. Although we believe our expectations are based on reasonable assumptions, by their very nature, forward-looking statements involve risks and uncertainties and may be influenced by factors that could cause actual results to differ materially from those expressed or implied by these forward-looking statements. Any forward-looking statements made on this call reflect the knowledge and information available at the time of the call. The company undertakes no obligation to update forward-looking statements. Please also carefully review the forward-looking statements disclaimer in the slide presentation that accompanies this conference call. There will be an opportunity to ask questions after the presentations. Please press star one on your telephone handset to ask a question. I will now hand you over to AstraZeneca's Chief Executive Officer, Pascal Soriot. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you, operator. Good morning, good afternoon, everybody, and thank you so much for taking the time to join us today on a Sunday. This is not a webcast, it's a conference call, so you will have to follow from the slides that you can actually download from our website. As always, you can get the slide deck from the AstraZeneca website, and we will be guiding you by giving you the slide number so you can follow the presentation. It is a very exciting day for us, and hopefully you are as excited as we are with this result. It is definitely an important day for patients with heart failure and really a lot of good data that were presented today. It is not so often that you see a study presentation received the way Professor McMurray's presentation was received today. So truly a great set of data, and we look forward to the Q&A with you. So if you look at slide two, this is the forward-looking statement. You've just heard that. On slide three, you see the people present today. Professor John McMurray will be presenting the data and answering your questions. Also available on the call for Q&A is Mene Pangalos, our Executive Vice President for the Biopharmaceutical R&D Group, and Ruud Dobber, who is the EVP for Biopharmaceuticals, the business unit. And also we have Elisabeth Björk, who is our SVP for the CVRM, what we call CVRM, cardiovascular and metabolism and our kidney renal franchise. So if you look at slide four, I will quickly give you an introduction, and then very importantly, Professor McMurray will take you through the data, and then we will have the Q&A. Now, today, Professor McMurray has to leave us at 5:40 CET, Paris time, so we will make sure that we start with the questions related to the data and to his presentation, and we'll keep the more general questions relating to the company and the impact this data could have on AstraZeneca for the second part of the Q&A. So if you move now to slide five, this is quite a special ESC for us this year with a wide set of data presented, not only FARXIGA, of course, the DAPA-HF data are the most significant data we're presenting, but we also presented very important data from the FAMIS study referring to the use of Brilinta in diabetic patients with CAD, and in particular, very positive risk-benefit in the PCI subgroup. But in parallel to those data, we have announced recently a Fast Track designation in the U.S. for CKD for dapagliflozin, and we are still continuing to roll out the results of the DECLARE study. We got approval in Europe, and we're expecting approval in the United States any day now. And finally, as you know, we have a second study called DELIVER that is ongoing in heart failure again, but in preserved ejection fraction. So moving to slide six, there is, as you know, a very large number of patients on a global basis who suffer from either diabetes, heart failure, 425 million diabetic patients worldwide, 64 million are affected with heart failure. There's about 18 million cardiovascular deaths every year, and 200 million people who suffer from chronic kidney disease, and there's a common threat to all those diseases. So a lot of patient suffering, but also a lot of costs to healthcare systems. You see here on this slide, the cost of heart failure, $31 billion in the United States alone. Heart failure is a very, very costly disease because patients live a very difficult, sometimes miserable life, but they live long lives, and they tend to be hospitalized very regularly and, of course, cost a lot of money and have a big impact on healthcare systems. So clearly, those data are very, very welcome. So if you look at slide 7, you see here, presented the reason why we've taken this approach over the last many years across not only diabetes, but also heart failure, cardiovascular disease, and kidney disease, because we believe that our portfolio of products is addressing many aspects of those various diseases, and certainly Farxiga is now demonstrating that it has value across each of those. But you can also see that Brilinta has application in diabetic patients, as we've demonstrated at this ESC, but also, of course, more broad in cardiovascular disease. We have Roxadustat in development, and we look forward to presenting those data. We have Lokelma that is being launched right now in the United States. And, of course, Badureon and Epanova, which is still in late-stage development. So you can see here illustrated our strategy basically coming to fruition and the hard work of many of our people around the world over the last many years. So I will stop here, and I will hand over to Professor McMurray, who will take you through the presentation. So, John, over to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So it's my pleasure to present the results of the dapagliflozin in patients with heart failure and reduced ejection fraction trial, DAPA-HF. I am, of course, doing this on behalf of a big team of people, both the academics who worked with AstraZeneca to design and run this trial, and, of course, the AstraZeneca team who made this trial so successful. I'm now on slide 10. The background to our trial is that we know that sodium glucose cotransporter 2 SGLT2 inhibitors prevent the development of heart failure in patients with type 2 diabetes. That was shown in DECLARE, among other trials. That was in people who didn't have heart failure to start with. What we wanted to find out was whether these drugs might actually be useful as a treatment for patients with established heart failure. And not only that, but we wanted to see whether these drugs might be useful even in patients without type 2 diabetes. The reason for that is that there is experimental evidence that SGLT2 inhibitors may have glucose-independent benefits. So we tested these hypotheses by randomizing patients to receive either dapagliflozin, a single tablet of 10 milligrams once daily, or placebo added to standard therapy. That's very important. I'll come back to that. In patients with heart failure and reduced ejection fraction, patients both with and without type 2 diabetes. Slide 11 shows a summary of the trial design, the key features, although I have to say this is pretty typical of the design of any recent HFrEF trial. Patients had a reduced ejection fraction, modestly elevated natriuretic peptide levels. We excluded people if they had a very low EGFR or if they had a very low systolic blood pressure, EGFR less than 30, systolic blood pressure less than 95 millimeters of mercury. Our primary endpoint, as is usual these days, was a composite of a worsening heart failure event or cardiovascular mortality. Slide 12 shows you a figure illustrating what we did in the study. So after patients consented and went through the inclusion-exclusion procedures. They were randomized equally to placebo or dapagliflozin. They were followed up, as shown at the bottom of the slide, until 844 primary endpoints had accrued. That was our target number of events. Slide 13 shows you where we did this trial. So we had an amazing team of national leaders who, working with the AstraZeneca companies in these different countries, did a great job in recruiting 4,744 patients in record time in 20 different countries representing most regions of the world. Slide 14 shows you the key baseline characteristics. I would make two general comments about this. Firstly, these are very typical of every other heart failure with reduced ejection fraction trial. And secondly, the characteristics are very well balanced between the two treatment groups. Maybe pick out one or two things to highlight. Firstly, if you look at NYHA class, New York Heart Association class, so class 2 means patients have mild symptoms, class 3 means moderately severe symptoms, class 4 means severe symptoms. Most of these patients had mild or moderately severe symptoms. The other thing to point out is the eGFR, a measure of their kidney function. It was 66, above 90 would be regarded as normal. In fact, 41% of these patients had chronic kidney disease, in other words, an eGFR of less than 60. 42% had a prior diagnosis of type 2 diabetes. We found a few more in the enrollment period who had previously undiagnosed diabetes. So we had a total of 45% of patients with type 2 diabetes at baseline. Very importantly and crucial to our hypothesis, 55% did not have type 2 diabetes. Moving to slide 15, another critically important slide, because it shows you the background therapy that patients were getting. Again, two general comments. Firstly, these patients were very well treated with contemporary therapy, and those treatments were very well balanced between the two treatment groups. To be a bit more specific, 94% roughly were on a renin-angiotensin system blocker, 96% on a beta blocker. I didn't say this at the Congress today, but this is actually the highest proportion of patients in any prior trial treated with a beta blocker, 71% patients treated with a mineralocorticoid receptor antagonist, again, the highest proportion that we've seen in any similar trial. 11% of our patients were on a neprilysin inhibitor in addition to a RAS blocker, in other words, sacubitril valsartan. That relatively low percentage is simply because this treatment was beginning to be used at the time that we started enrollment in DAPA-HF, but I'll come back to that later on because it's probably a crucial question. Slide 16 shows what happened to patients in the trial. I'll highlight three things, I think, on this slide. Firstly, the median duration of follow-up was 18.2 months. Secondly, if you look down at the bottom boxes on either side, you'll see 249 patients discontinued study drug in the DAPA group, 258 in the placebo group. That was only 10.7% of patients overall discontinued study drug during follow-up, a testament to really how well this trial was done and how well tolerated the treatment was. Even more importantly, you can see at the very bottom that only two patients had unknown vital status at the end of this study. We saw a lot of trials today presented with excellent follow-up, but none of them had as complete follow-up as in DAPA-HF. So slide 17 says I'm moving to the primary outcome, and slide 18 shows the primary composite outcome. So it had three components: cardiovascular death, heart failure hospitalization, or an urgent heart failure visit requiring treatment with intravenous therapy. Each of these three components was analyzed on a time to first event basis, but actually very few of the first events were an urgent heart failure visit. most of the first events were either heart failure hospitalization or cardiovascular death. As you can see, if you look at the Kaplan-Meier curves, they separated early, and the separation continued during the duration of follow-up. The difference was large. There was a 26% relative risk reduction, highly statistically significant, with a number needed to treat over only 18 months median follow-up of 21. The next slide, slide 19, shows you that we reduced both of the components of the primary composite outcome significantly. We reduced a worsening heart failure event by 30%. As I said, this is principally heart failure hospitalization, and heart failure hospitalization was reduced by 30%, highly statistically significant. We even reduced cardiovascular mortality significantly. That was reduced by 18%. So slide 20 shows you our 14 pre-specified subgroups. And really, this slide is mainly to show you the consistency of treatment benefit across the different subgroups of interest. I'm going to highlight one of those in just a moment, but maybe I'll mention one other one that I didn't pull out at the Congress, but is very, very important, and that's the subgroup of patients treated with a mineralocorticoid receptor antagonist at baseline, an entirely consistent benefit in that subgroup. But the subgroup that everybody wanted to know about was, of course, the subgroup analyzed by diabetes status at baseline. And here you see the benefit of treatment on the primary endpoint in patients with diabetes, that's yes, and in patients without diabetes, that's no. You can see that the hazard ratio was 0.75 in patients who had a history of who had diabetes at baseline, and 0.73 in patients who did not have diabetes at baseline. Entirely consistent benefit, in fact, within subgroup statistical significance within each of those subgroups in favor of dapagliflozin. Slide 22, which is the next slide, shows you a non-pre-specified subgroup. We felt that we should show this because we know that people are going to ask about it. And this is looking at that 11% of patients who were on sacubitril valsartan at baseline. And you can see that once again, the treatment effect size was identical in those patients compared to all other patients. The point estimate for the hazard ratio was 0.75 in patients getting an ARNI at baseline, 0.74 in those who were not. So an entirely consistent treatment benefit even in patients getting sacubitril valsartan. And finally, I'll take you quickly through the secondary outcomes, slide 23. I'm going to show you these in order of the pre-specified hierarchical testing procedure. So our first pre-specified secondary endpoint was the more traditional composite endpoint in heart failure trials in recent years. That's the composite of cardiovascular death or heart failure hospitalization, essentially the same as our primary endpoint, and of course significantly reduced by dapagliflozin compared to placebo. Slide 25, I think, shows maybe a more important and more up-to-date approach, perhaps, to looking at what happens to patients with heart failure, and that's looking at total events, not just looking at the time to first occurrence of events, but actually looking at all events, because, of course, many patients with heart failure are admitted to hospital on more than one occasion. And again, you can see that even when we took account of recurrent admissions to hospital, there was a substantial and significant reduction with dapagliflozin compared to placebo. Slide 26 shows the next pre-specified secondary outcome, and this looks at patient-reported symptoms. So we give the patient something called the Kansas City cardiomyopathy questionnaire to complete, and this shows you what is called the total symptom score, one of the domains in that, one of the summary scores in that questionnaire. And you can see that at the pre-specified time that we analyzed change in symptoms, that was 8 months, change from baseline to 8 months favored dapagliflozin over placebo. Now, not many people really used to looking at KCCQ and might think that a 2.8-point difference is not very large, but actually in an overall patient population with heart failure, that is as large has been seen previously with any effective treatment, either a drug or a device in previous trials. On slide 27 is perhaps an easier to understand an analysis of symptoms. This was also pre-specified, and this is looking at what is considered as a clinically important or clinically meaningful change in symptoms, and by convention that's a 5 or greater point change from baseline. And this table shows you the proportions of patients in the two treatment groups having either a clinically important improvement in their symptoms or a clinically important deterioration in their symptoms. And you can see that more patients in the dapagliflozin group showed an improvement in symptoms, and significantly fewer patients in the dapagliflozin group showed a deterioration in their symptoms. So not only did dapagliflozin reduce hospital admissions, reduce cardiovascular mortality, but it also improved symptoms or stopped deterioration in symptoms. The penultimate pre-specified secondary endpoint was a worsening renal function composite outcome. In our relatively short-term study in patients with heart failure, in fact, few patients developed one of these renal endpoints. And although there were numerically fewer events in the dapagliflozin group than the placebo group, this difference was not statistically significant between the two groups, but the trend was in the right direction, but very few events overall. And finally, our last pre-specified endpoint secondary outcome, that was all-cause mortality, last but of course still very important for the patient. And here you can see again that there was a nominally statistically significant reduction in all-cause mortality. There was a 17% relative risk reduction in death. Lastly, of course, it's important to look at safety and tolerability. We pre-specified that we would look in particular at certain adverse events of interest, that we would look at adverse events leading to discontinuation of study drug, and finally, of course, we looked at serious adverse events. And here you can see the percent of patients with each of these. The first thing to say is that the adverse events that perhaps we were most interested in as heart failure doctors, adverse events related to volume depletion, so hypotension, dehydration, these were actually quite uncommon and not significantly different between treatment groups. The same was true for renal adverse events, and in fact, if you look at the footnotes of the slide, you'll see that serious renal adverse events were actually less common in the dapagliflozin group. All of the other adverse events of interest were very uncommon. There's one that I didn't list on the table because I didn't have space. That was Fournier's gangrene. That was reported in one patient in the placebo group. There were no more patients who stopped randomized therapy because of adverse events, 4.7 versus 4.9%. And in fact, serious adverse events overall were significantly less frequent in the dapagliflozin group than in the placebo group. So the conclusions that we presented a few minutes ago here at the Congress were that we found that dapagliflozin reduced the risk of worsening heart failure events, reduced cardiovascular death, and improved symptoms in patients with HFrEF when added to really very good standard conventional therapy. The relative and absolute risk reductions in death and hospitalization were really quite substantial, we believe clinically important, and that was very much supported by the commentator, and these benefits were consistent across all the important subgroups that we looked at, and especially, of course, in patients who did not have type 2 diabetes at baseline. We found that dapagliflozin given as a single dose once daily was well tolerated. The rate of treatment discontinuation was low, and in our view, dapagliflozin now really offers a completely novel approach to the treatment of patients with heart failure and reduced ejection fraction.
Thank you so much, Professor McMurray. It's rare to have a set of data or clinical results so clear and so strong, so very exciting study for sure. So we'll now move to the question, the Q&A. As a reminder, if you have a question, please dial star one. And also, as I said earlier, if you could, for the time being, focus your questions on the study itself and the clinical implications of those results, and questions for Professor McMurray. And then we'll cover your other questions in the second part of the Q&A. I believe we have a first question from Tim Anderson. So, Tim, go ahead, please.
Hi. A couple questions. Thank you very much. It's the subgroup analysis with Farxiga and Entresto concurrently where it showed equal benefit if patients were either on or off Entresto. The question is, do you think this will cause the market to move away from use of Entresto, viewing it as not necessary? It seems to answer that question, we'd actually want to see the same type of subgroup analysis that you did on slide 22 for patients on a pure ACE or a pure ARB without the neprilysin inhibitor, and maybe even that type of sub-analysis in patients not on an ACE or ARB or ARNI at all, so only on drugs like beta blockers or MRAs. So that's the first question. And then the second question is looking at this in HFpEF and kind of looking at, again, another Novartis set of results, the Paragon trial, favorable trends, missed statistical significance. In your trial today, DAP-HF, you show a bigger benefit in HFrEF relative to Paradigm. So I'm wondering if you think the confidence in your HFpEF trial, you know, is higher. So we saw a trend with the Novartis product. You know, maybe you actually have a much higher chance of success just based on what we're seeing today in the separate HFrEF population.
Okay, well, thank you very much. So I can't comment on moving the market. That's not my job. But I can say something about the RNA subgroups. So truthfully, I think that these are completely complementary treatments. I think it's quite clear that dapagliflozin is additive to sacubitril valsartan. And why wouldn't it be? Why would a neprilysin inhibitor and an SGLT2 inhibitor in some way overlap in their mechanism of action? They're completely different types of drugs. If they were both beneficial, I would expect them to have additive benefit, just like beta blockers do with ACE inhibitors, just like MRAs do with ACE inhibitors and beta blockers. And with respect to your question about, should we look at patients who were just on an ACE inhibitor or ARB and not on an RNA, well, that's the vast, vast majority of our patients. It's more than 80% of our patients. And even though we haven't done that because it didn't seem something that we should do, but we could do it, but I'm 110% confident it will show exactly the same treatment effect because it represents the overwhelming majority of patients in the trial. In terms of DELIVER, in other words, the trial using dapagliflozin in patients with heart failure and preserved ejection fraction, I was the co-PI of the Paragon heart failure trial. We missed statistical significance by seven events. That is all it would have taken to tip that value from one side of p.05 to the other side. So do I think that we can do a trial that shows benefit in patients with HFpEF? Absolutely. Do I think this treatment might be more likely to be effective? Probably. I can think of more mechanistic reasons why an SGLT2 inhibitor would be more likely to be of benefit than sacubitril valsartan. So I think I've answered your second question as well as your first one.
Great, thank you.
John, it's Pascal here. Maybe what I could do is rephrase the team's question, actually, because maybe you could address it. I think another way to phrase the first question would be, what do you think clinicians will do when they see those results? One argument could be those products, both Entresto and DAPA, ultimately should be combined with to treat patients better. And maybe the question would be, in what order do they start? But do you think they will be combined or not combined? Maybe it would be another way to ask you the question from a clinical viewpoint.
I'm sure they will be combined, and some of us already are doing that. Because we've already had an indication for using SGLT2 inhibitors in patients with diabetes and heart failure. So we've already got, in the heart failure world, I would say, reasonable experience of using these two drugs together. They're quite easy to use together. And I think if I was the patient with heart failure and reduced ejection fraction in September 2019, I would absolutely want to be on sacubitril valsartan, a beta blocker, a mineralocorticoid receptor antagonist, and dapagliflozin. It's very, very clear that that would give me the best chance of feeling well, remaining well, staying out of hospital, and staying alive. The data are completely clear to me. Now, in terms of all these difficult questions about what should people do first, what should they do second, I really don't want to get into that because that, to me, is veering too much towards marketing. I suspect, I don't support this view necessarily, but I suspect what's going to happen is that SGLT2 inhibitors will be used more readily than sacubitril valsartan, which sadly isn't used enough. And the reason I say that is because of the tolerability. There's not a problem with blood pressure. There's not a problem with renal function. It's a once-daily drug. It doesn't cause hyperkalemia. You saw how few people, 10.7% of people, stopped treatment during follow-up. That's remarkable. We saw trials today where getting up to 30% of people had stopped treatment during follow-up. So I suspect, but I don't know, and I'm not advocating this at all, but I suspect doctors may vote with their feet because it's usually simpler and easier to use things that are better tolerated, don't cause problems.
Thank you. The next question is from Andrew Baum. I think, Andrew, you have a question. Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Murray. Just thinking about the inclusion-exclusion criteria of the trial, if I remember correctly, the PARADIGM trial with sacubitril and Diovan combined was only thought to represent approximately 60% of the real-world patients seen by many cardiologists based on the inclusion-exclusion criteria. Could you just comment on DAPA-HF? So what percentage of the real-world CHF patients that a cardiologist is likely to see is contained within that data set? And obviously, I'm thinking about the commercial implication of that. And then second, in answer to the question about whether this is a diuretic-driven effect, an expensive diuretic, it would seem to be unlikely given the baseline therapy, which is obviously very high for diuretics, but we don't have information about the intensification of that diuretic therapy. So do we have any additional information on the baseline diuretic treatment that would outline that actually we're doing something different than just intensify diuretic therapy with dapagliflozin in this trial? Thank you.
Okay, two tough questions. So the real world thing is very difficult. I was co-PI of PARADIGM and have to say got quite upset sometimes when people talked about their extrapolations from the trial to the real world, because the reason that you saw those low proportions of patients was people took our run-in phase in paradigm heart failure and said that if patients were not already on a full dose of ACE inhibitor, then technically they were not eligible for the paradigm heart failure trial. And of course, if you go out into the real world, not everybody is on the guideline recommended maximum dose of ACE inhibitor. So that's where some of those 60% type proportions came from. If you apply that same sort of logic, then of course this is going to be a much larger proportion of patients. We didn't have a run-in period. Patients fulfilled inclusion-exclusion criteria and were randomized. They were not required to tolerate dapagliflozin before they could be randomized. We didn't discontinue patients because they couldn't take the treatment, which is what happened in paradigm heart failure. So whatever number you believe paradigm heart failure represents in the real world, this is going to represent, I would say, substantially more. In terms of your second question about diuretics, well, you're absolutely right. I mean, almost all of our patients were on a diuretic, and the vast majority of those were on a loop diuretic. And we didn't actually know whether dapagliflozin would continue to have any diuretic effect when added to powerful background diuretic therapy. And in any case, we know that with SGLT2 inhibitors, the diuretic effect wears off. It tends to be transient and relatively short-lived. But saying that, because we anticipated this question might come up, we have looked at what happened to diuretic dosing during follow-up, and we've also looked at what happens to diuretic dosing during follow-up in other trials not using an SGLT2 inhibitor. And the reason we did that was because, of course, if you make people better, their diuretic requirement is reduced. So what we found in dapagliflozin is that a somewhat smaller proportion of patients on dapagliflozin therapy had an increase in diuretic dose during follow-up, but the difference was just a few percent. A larger proportion had a reduction in diuretic therapy, but the difference was quite small. And when we compared this to another trial that we did with a drug that's not a diuretic by any manner of means, an angiotensin receptor blocker, we found pretty much exactly the same pattern. In other words, you do get slightly fewer people needing an increase in their dose of diuretic, slightly more able to reduce their dose of diuretic with any effects of therapy that makes people feel better, keeps them out of hospital, stops their heart failure progressing and deteriorating, which is, of course, the goal of all the treatments that we use in these patients. I don't know if that answers your question satisfactorily, but that's the best I think I can do.
Thank you.
Okay, so the next question is from Seamus Fernandez. Go ahead, Seamus.
Oh, thanks. Just a couple of quick questions for Dr. McMurray. When you looked at the efficacy of Entresto in combination with Farxiga, obviously we saw an impressive benefit. However, did you guys take a look at the frequency of side effects, so the frequency of hypotension of that combination? Was there any evidence of an increase in side effects of the combined of the two drugs in combination? Then just as a second question, if you were just to estimate how you plan to use this, this agent or if the combination is already standard of care in your diabetic patient population, I believe that the percentage of patients that were pre-diabetic was quite substantial in the trial. Just hoping to better understand if those subgroups were actually looked at, the pre-diabetic and then the normal patient population as well. Thanks.
Okay, so I have not looked at adverse events in the 11% of people who were on sacubitril valsartan, the baseline 500-odd patients, simply because we haven't had time to do that. So I honestly don't know the answer to your question. With respect to the second question about the patients who did not have diabetes at baseline, yes, of course, as we know, in heart failure, many patients have got pre-diabetic dysglycemia. We have looked, though we have not published, and we don't want to present this information until the next large cardiology congress, but we have looked at this question. And if you divide patients who are not diabetic into equal groups according to their hemoglobin A1C, the treatment benefit is completely consistent across those quartiles of hemoglobin A1C. In other words, there's no evidence that the treatment effect is less in patients with a low hemoglobin A1C compared to patients with a higher hemoglobin A1C. But that's not public information. That is slated for presentation at an upcoming large congress.
And if I could ask just one quick follow-up, what about the frequency of, was there any evidence of pyelonephritis or differences in urogenital infections based on HbA1c status, or is that something that you plan to look at? Thanks.
No, well, we did not collect information on adverse events related to urogenital fungal infections, because we know all about that, and there's no question that there is a small excess of genital fungal infections with SGLT2 inhibitors. That's well known. That was not a targeted adverse event that we were interested in. We, of course, did look at serious adverse events, for example, reflecting urosepsis, and there was no significant excess of serious adverse events for urosepsis or indeed any other type of infection or indeed any serious adverse event at all. There is no difference between the treatment groups.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. And we'll take maybe the last question because Professor McMurray needs to leave at 5:45. So the last question is from Peter Welford. Peter, go ahead.
Hi, yeah, thanks for taking my questions and squeezing me in. Just two hopefully quick ones. First of all, did you look at the time to next treatment in this study? And particularly as well, did you look at the percentage of patients or the number where Entresto was added, I guess, across the two arms? And then secondly, I guess coming back to some extent Pascal's question, but that's a bit further, which is if you were to see a patient in your office today and you had or that patient already obviously on the full dose of ARBs, beta blockers, et cetera, and they were not on either Entresto or Farxiga, I guess, are there any particular subgroups, I guess, if you're going to add one first, where you think the Farxiga may be the better option, I guess, as the first drug to use based on this data set and obviously what you know about the two therapies? Thank you.
So the only analysis of drugs started after randomization that we've done so far is to look at diuretic doses, and I mentioned that in my previous reply. We've not looked at the number of patients who were started on sacubitril valsartan during follow-up, although I imagine there were definitely more people on sacubitril valsartan by the end of the trial than there were at the start. But we've not looked at that, so I'm afraid I can't tell you that. In terms of the patient who walked into my office today, well, today the labeling allows me to use dapagliflozin as a treatment for diabetes. So if I had a heart failure patient who had diabetes, I could do that according to what the drug's approved to do. I could do that according to the guideline recommendations. So that's what I would do today. Of course, we have to wait and see what the regulators and the guidelines say about the non-diabetic HFrEF patients. But assuming that this drug is approved as a more general treatment for heart failure, then of course I'll use it. And I think, as I've said to you earlier, there's no question that if you were a patient with HFrEF, you'd like to be in both of these treatments.
Very good. So, John, thank you so much. We want to be respectful of your time, and I know you have another presentation to go to, so we probably will ask Elizabeth to answer any other clinical questions there. So let me thank you again, John, for a fantastic study, and for your willingness to come and contribute to this. So the next question, I think, is a question from Marietta Mimitz. So Marietta, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks for taking my questions. I have a follow-up question on the PEF issue. Have you looked at all at the correlation between ejection fraction and efficacy, or when should we actually expect that sort of data, and how do you think that bodes for DELIVER? Because I think, you know, what we saw in other heart failure trials is that really the higher the ejection fraction, the less the efficacy. So at some point, maybe the efficacy just maxes out. And what are the mechanisms for REF and PEF efficacy for this drug? Are they different in PEF compared to REF? I mean, we know the diuretic effect, but there seems to be a lot more at play here. Second question is just in terms of, you know, have you had any feedback from key opinion leaders who are cautious about using an anti-diabetic in non-diabetics and how you're going to address that? I mean, we heard that there were no differences in serious adverse events, but is there any concern about sort of longer-term metabolic changes in non-diabetic patients if they get given an anti-diabetic? And the final question is the discrepancy between the efficacy on heart failure and hospitalization on the one hand and on the cardiovascular and non-cardiovascular death. Do you have any insights into that? What were some of the causes of cardiovascular or non-cardiovascular death that were frequent and not prevented by this medicine? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. So we'll ask Elizabeth, together with Anna Maria, who I should say today have done an absolutely stellar job conducting this study. You heard Professor McMurray a few minutes ago tell you how few patients were lost in that study, amazing quality in the study. So Elizabeth and Anna Maria, do you want to take those questions?
Yes, we will definitely do that. You had several of them, so we will do our best to try to cover them, and you will have to go back if we don't do that. So we start with I will start with some of the more general questions and then hand over to Anna Maria. First, whether cardiologists are reassured by sort of the data we are seeing here, or if they think they will continue to have concerns using an anti-diabetic drug outside diabetes. The ones that we have been speaking with here today are very impressed by the data and exactly the fact that we are seeing very consistent results between non-diabetics and diabetics, and especially that the safety profile is very similar across the score is very reassuring for them. And as you heard Professor McMurray comment on before, that the efficacy level seems to be the same regardless of where you are from a metabolism perspective, so it's not related to your HbA1c level. That is also very reassuring. So we think this will be good in that context. So I think I will hand over to Anna Maria to answer some of the more detailed questions related to the study and also around the mechanism of action.
Thank you very much. So I start with a question about the effect size in according to ejection fraction. And based on the data presented today, the effect is consistent, irrespective of ejection fraction. We will, of course, do additional analysis on this and come back when we have assessed all the details, and that will be presented at subsequent meetings. The other question was around the diabetes and non-diabetes population, and I want to emphasize that we do see efficacy in the non-diabetes population on the heart failure events and CV death, and it is consistent. When you look at, for example, hypoglycemia, it's balanced between the treatment groups, and it only occurs in diabetic patients. So the data supports the use also in non-diabetic that is both efficacious and safe.
And Maya, there was also a question on the apparent discrepancy of results between effect on heart failure hospitalization versus CV death.
Yes, so I can also say that what we have seen when it comes to the CV deaths, yes, we have seen a reduction in CV death, which is important. We have seen it in the type of events that you would expect, so that is sudden death and heart failure events. and that will also be explained further in subsequent publications and so on. So based on the data now, it is as what you would expect.
And what are the mechanisms that you think bring about the effect in RAF and PEF?
So I think that's an excellent question. I think we need to remember that the SGLT2 inhibitors do affect a key transport in the kidney that transport both sodium and glucose. It's not only glucose, and that's very clear from these results. The sodium component is very important. It has secondary effects on the hemodynamics and the handling of sodium, and it also has secondary metabolic effects. And it is a combination of these effects that give the unique effect here, and in my view, it's not the diuretic effect.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you. So the next question is from Robert Shaw. Robert, go ahead.
Yes, Robert Shaw from Redburn. Many thanks for taking my questions. The data look excellent across the board, so I think the real question relates to what is Farcio worth in this indication. We have little by way of numbers for this, so Where do you see the sales potential really? Thank you.
Go ahead, Aud. Yeah, I was just going to suggest you answer that one.
Thank you so much. Now, first of all, we will never disclose, let's say, our own internal projections, but I can give a little bit of numbers. There are roughly 64 million patients with heart failure. Roughly 50% of those patients have a reduced ejection fraction. So it's a very, very substantial population, and what you have seen of the data, there's still a high unmet medical need. So in your own models, you can try to forecast the potential of this drug. But in principle, assuming that it will be registered by the regulators across the world, it's a very, very substantial opportunity for us as a business.
Thank you,
Robert. So the next question is from Sam Fazeli at Bloomberg. Sam, go ahead.
Thank you very much. It's Sam Fazeli from Bloomberg Intelligence. I'm hoping you can hear me. I have a question that actually goes back to Tim's question at the beginning, and I know that Dr. Murray isn't there anymore, but perhaps you could address it. Back to the question of whether the neprilysin inhibitor actually makes a difference in this setting, looking at this data, it appears that we get the same risk reduction irrespective of whether you have the product there or not, whether it's Entresto or just a cheap generic in the background. So if you could just cover that aspect again, obviously I know that you don't necessarily may want to refer to Entresto specifically whether it's in this setting or not, but I just want to understand the HR is identical between those two groups. Two more quick questions. You had 55% of patients in the trial which did not have diabetes. Is that representative of the population of HFrEF patients? Lastly, I know that infections were not looked at specifically, but do you have any indication whether genital infections were as frequent in the non-diabetic patient group as in the diabetic patient group? Thank you.
Thank you. So a few good questions for Anna Maria or Elizabeth.
Yes, so I'll start with the question on the ARNI subgroup. And as indicated by Professor McMurray earlier, mechanistically these two classes of drugs, the SGLT2 inhibitors and dapagliflozin and the neprilysin inhibitors are complementary. There's no physiological reason why they would not be additive. So but the biology, the science supports the finding in this study with consistent effects between these two subgroups. And that's all I can comment at the moment. The second question was around the genital infections. I cannot comment specifically on the different subgroups and safety. That work is ongoing. But as noted before, we did look at the serious adverse events of infection. They were extremely few. And it was no difference. If I recall it correctly, I think it was one, and I actually think it was in the placebo group, genital infection. So there's no indication that there would be a problem here.
Anna Maria, there was also a question about the 55% non-diabetics in the study.
Thank you.
Is a good representation of the the population.
So one very key objective of this study was to have a representative heart failure population. We've been monitoring that all through the study. And we know from recent heart failure trials with other classes that this is the proportion that you do see in a representative heart failure population. So we are confident that we have studied a representative heart failure population when it comes to diabetes status.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And so we maybe we'll finish with one question from Tim Anderson. Tim, go ahead.
Thank you. Kind of a commercial question. Loss of exclusivity, at least in the U.S., is 2025 on Farcia. That doesn't leave a very large window to commercialize these great results from DAPA-HF by the time you get a label. I think I know the answer here, but is there anything that can be done to make that window larger and longer? You could theoretically look at things like a different dose in a new trial, or potentially formally combining Farxiga with another medicine in a fixed-dose combination, maybe even Entresto or another product like a beta blocker. So any comments there would be helpful. Thank you.
Lenny, we great question. Tim, I would say, first of all, that 2025 is not that far away, but it's still 5 or 6 years. We will certainly do the most we can do out of this period of time, and we are looking at ways to fast-track the impact of these results on clinical practice in the near term. And we certainly also are looking at long-term, what can we do? And we are not going to disclose our plans today, but certainly we are going to look at, you know, what are the options to extend the patent life of this agent, because it's clearly a transformation for heart failure. And I suspect, I hope, fingers crossed, we should also have good results in CKD. So an agent that will have an impact on heart failure and CKD is a very important asset, of course. Yeah. But a little bit early to disclose more on our plans.
Yeah.
So maybe actually there's another question. Is that okay, Tim?
Yeah, thank you very much.
Good. And then maybe the last one, there's a question that just came in from Sachin. Go ahead, Sachin. Sounds like we've lost Sachin.
Sorry about that.
Okay.
Sorry, can you hear me now? Okay.
Yes, absolutely. Go ahead.
Yeah, sorry about that. So just a couple of questions, if I may. So firstly, commercial, when we think about some recent CV launches, so your own Brilinta, Entresto, or the PCSK9s, there was a lot of enthusiasm around the data. And then post-commercialization, there were various reasons why those launches kicked off slowly or they've built over time. So as we think about potential uptake here, are there any factors that you've identified in discussing with physicians that you need to address to get this launched effectively and to not repeat some prior CV launches? The second is obviously pro-BNP screening was part of the criteria. Do you just run through whether there's any complexity around that? It doesn't appear to be, but do you think it's been a sort of barrier? And then finally, Jardiance obviously is running a similar study, EMPEROR, with data due next year. From the existing diabetes data, although it's cross-trial comparison, there seems to be a perception that the Jardiance data in diabetes was stronger, some reference to CV death data. So do you expect docs to await the outcome of that data before choosing on which SGLT to proceed with, or how do you think that will play out? Thank you.
Thanks, Sachin. So a couple of questions. What I propose we do is we ask Elizabeth and Anna Maria to answer two questions, and that would be the pro-BNP question, but also I would propose that they address CV death comment you made, actually, Sachin, because I think it is really important to remember when we look at CV death, remember the population that was studied and the balance of post-MI patients in the different studies, and that it certainly influences the effect. So if Anna-Maria or Elizabeth, you could answer that, and then Ruth could comment on the launch phase and the ramp-up, keeping in mind, of course, it's... If you have Entresto in mind, Sachin, Entresto, when it was launched, it had zero access, whereas today Farxiga has access already in the United States. But Elizabeth, go ahead, and then Ruth could cover the other questions.
Yeah, I'll try to start by addressing the cardiovascular death question, and then I'll ask Anna Maria to do the pre-BNP question and build on my CV death as she see fit here. So I think, Sachin, you are referring to the fact that in the DECLARE trial, where we studied a broad patient population of patients with both primary prevention and secondary prevention, although we were able to see a significant reduction in the hospitalization for heart failure and also in the renal events, we did not see the same signal on cardiovascular death as EMPA did in their EMPA-REG trial. Having said that, then when we in the DECLARE trial look at the more sick patients, the ones who have had a myocardial infarctions before, the ones that had heart failure at baseline, etc., we were also able to see a reduction in cardiovascular death that was similar to what you saw with empagliflozin. And the fact that we now, when we are taking this drug into the sickest of the patients with heart failure, regardless of whether they have diabetes or not, are able to see a significant reduction in cardiovascular death ties all of this together for me, and we are able to see in the broad patient population reduction of hospitalization for heart failure, the renal events, a trend to cardiovascular death in the sickest patient population confirmed in these patients here. So I think the cardiovascular death story now is coming together very clearly with the addition of this data. So I'll ask Anna Maria to see if she wants to build on anything on that now, and otherwise also ask answer the pro-BNP question.
So I thought it was hard for me to hear the question, but I can make a comment on NT-proBNP. So the mean NT-proBNP was almost 1,500 in the trial at baseline, and we saw a consistent effect on the composite endpoint across above and below the median of NT-proBNP. We haven't looked into the data in further detail, so we will have to come back with that. Was there another question that I did not get?
Do you expect that screening to be any complexity within the launch profile, which may build into how Ruud answers the launch update question?
So Sachin, let me take that question. First of all, Pascal was spot on that, of course, the big difference with the Entresto and equally the Brilinta launch is that the product is already listed in many formularies in the United States. We also believe that this data set will further strengthen our position in those formularies and potentially will increase. We are covered in a good way in the United States, but with this data set, we have the hope and the clear ambition in order to get covered in more formularies across the country. Equally in Europe, and I take only one example, for example, the SGLT2 class in Italy can only be prescribed by diabetologists. And with this data set, we will firmly make a case to the Italian government that this product now also needs to be available for cardiologists. So all in all, I think it will clearly further strengthen the position of Farxiga, not only in the SGLT2 class, but in the overall class of anti-diabetic products. But equally, of course, clearly the data of today is showing that it is now also a cardiovascular drug. So all in all, I think a very positive story moving forward.
One thing I would add, actually, if I may, Sachin, is that, I think everybody focuses on empagliflozin, and I think we have to say empagliflozin is a good product. But the most important piece is that we need to totally shape the treatment of heart failure and the treatment of diabetes in the future. There's too much use of SUs in diabetes, for instance. And in fact, the class, the SGLT2 class, is completely underrepresented in terms of prescribing. So of course, it will remain very competitive with EMPA and others. These data, as Ruud said, will certainly strengthen our hand. I mean, for a change, we are ahead. We're number one to show data, positive data in a new indication, heart failure, but it will remain competitive. But really, the challenge for all of us, our competitors and ourselves, is really to make sure more patients benefit from SGLT2s as opposed to receiving our data treatment. It is quite a tragedy, actually, to see so many diabetic patients getting products that either don't help them or even sometimes hurt them. So I guess that's really what the way I would look at it. And then I'd like to go back to your question on ProBNP because I'd like to make sure we've covered it. Do you want to restate it so Anna Maria can make sure we answer it?
It's just very simply, I mean, I'm not expecting any complexity, but just thinking about launches, we've learned historically of various factors that impacted launch after launch. So I just wanted to be sure that the pro-BPNP screening criteria that are used in the study won't be viewed as prohibitive by physicians. It was as simple as that.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, okay. So maybe, Anna Maria, you can cover this and confirm that the criteria used are in line with common practice.
So they are in line with the heart failure trials that currently have been done. So I don't think that is going to be a major hurdle.
I think if there is a hurdle, potentially, is really to convince physicians to use what they see as an antidiabetic agent in non-diabetics. That's probably the one key thing we're going to have to work on. But the data have spoken, right? I mean, the efficacy is so strong, and the safety is absolutely pristine. So, and the product is incredibly easy to use. There's no titration or nothing. So that should really encourage physicians to consider it to treat heart failure patients. So with this, I would like to thank you again for your interest. It is a great set of data, and we're all very excited, but certainly a lot of work ahead of us, and we'll have to do our very best to maximize the ramp-up of this new indication. So thank you, and have a good rest of the day.